The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is the largest overhaul of the American healthcare system in nearly 50 years. It promises to reduce overall healthcare costs, expand coverage, and cut deficits in decades to come. But the fate of the plan's theoretical goals lies almost squarely in the hands of the so-called invincibles, young, healthy people that previously had no healthcare coverage, often voluntarily. With this in mind, how will Obamacare affect a 24-year-old in the new system? What is speculation caused by politics? What results are more certain? And what are the theories behind the main provisions of Obamacare? You're listening to Upset Patterns. Currently, 263 out of 311 million people have healthcare coverage in the United States. Of the 48 million uninsured, some are illegal immigrants, some voluntarily do not purchase coverage because they think they don't need it, some are shut out of the market because of pre-existing conditions, and some just can't afford it. Obamacare promises to cut the 48 million uninsured by 25 million in the next decade. So how's it going to work? Here to discuss with me what is likely to be the defining characteristic of President Obama's legacy in office is someone who's been to the doctor a couple times, Paige Atkinson. Paige, thank you for coming on.
Oh, no problem. I'm excited to hear what this is all about. I'm very, very confused.
First of all, before we go into the nitty-gritty of the law, it's important to understand the economic theory behind the idea of adverse selection. And adverse selection in insurance or financial markets means that there's an asymmetry of information. So the insurers, or let's say banks, don't know all of the information of the people they're treating. They don't know how risky they are. And this usually means that they have to raise their costs to account for this imperfect information. In the case of insurance too, adverse selection means that the people that need it the most, the riskiest people, are the ones buying it. And you can see this will make rates go up. In the case of pre-existing conditions, for example, if someone has a very terminal illness, they're obviously going to want health insurance. Now, health insurers see that this person is very expensive and will sometimes raise their rates to be very unaffordable or not give them coverage altogether. Those who choose not to get insurance, however, in the end might end up in the emergency room and the taxpayer will foot the bill anyway. Obamacare, how it tries to solve this problem is the, quote, individual mandate. And what that means is that everyone has to get health insurance. And so you're spreading this risk across the general population, and that way rates will go down.
Sounds like a pretty good idea. So the taxpayers won't have to pay for those people who end up in the hospital and can't pay for it.
Right. Under Obamacare, even though you're expanding coverage, the idea is that you're keeping the costs either lower or the same because you're getting rid of those, you know, after the fact catastrophes by insuring everyone and spreading the risk throughout the whole population.
Even though some may be riskier than others?
Right. So some individuals will be riskier than others. And the ones that thought that they were healthy enough or they're not going to need the insurance, they otherwise wouldn't be purchasing it.
Those invincibles you were talking about.
Exactly. So what the individual mandate exactly means, it says that you must have a plan that meets certain requirements. So you can't just buy a plan that says, cover me only if I explode or something. It has to meet certain criteria that makes it a high quality enough plan. And the penalty for not having one is a $95 fine or 1% of your income, whichever is more. And then it goes up gradually over the next few years until it's about $650.
Wow. So how much are these healthcare plans that people be buying that weren't buying healthcare before?
So there are a lot of different variables at play. Obamacare makes it so you can't discriminate on pre-existing conditions, which obviously, if you had unhealthy habits, your rates would be higher before. But Obamacare sort of levels all those out. It depends on how competitive your state's healthcare market is. And that's where the individual exchange comes in. People go on healthcare.gov and basically bid for a healthcare plan. They have four levels of plans, the bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And so if you want to really get all the care you want, you can get a platinum. That'll be more expensive. If you want more of a bare bones but still meet certain criteria, that'll be a bronze.
So why do people not support this?
Well, if you're one of those people who was an invincible, now you have to buy coverage when you otherwise wouldn't have to. Or let's say you're only spending $70 a month on your healthcare plan and it wasn't considered sufficient enough. So now you've got to pay for $400 worth. There are about 10 main criteria that Obamacare specifies your plan needs to have. And one of them, for example, is maternity care. So if you're a woman that is not of childbearing age, or if you basically aren't going to have a kid, you still need to include that in your plan. And where does that cost come from? It comes from your higher premiums. But it is important to note that Obamacare allows subsidies to make up for these higher costs. So depending on your income, you can make up part of that increased cost.
Is there an economic reason why this plan is making people pay for things they wouldn't necessarily need?
Well, it comes down to that adverse selection thing of trying to spread the risk through the population. And you could say that even though it's not efficient, from a social justice standpoint, it's important to us because we want, you know, health coverage is a necessary part of life, and we want the people who can't afford it or who have a pre-existing condition to not suffer. And so it is, in a sense, shifting the burden of the cost from other people. And then also, if you think of the invincible that goes to ER after a huge accident that they weren't expecting, hospitals have to take care of that person, and even though they make the best attempt they can to collect payments, if they can't, the hospital foots the bill, which usually just means that everyone else foots the bill with higher costs. In economic ways, it is efficient in that adverse selection solution and spreading risk, but you could say it's inefficient. Think of the market for car insurance. We charge people who, let's say they have a few DUIs under their belt or speeding tickets, or if they're a young teenager, we charge them higher rates. We don't know everything about those person's driving habits, but we do know that they tend to be more dangerous. That's called price discrimination. Obamacare actually makes it so that can't happen. So the smoker, the person who doesn't exercise, just leads unhealthy habits, they're going to be paying the same rate as the healthy person. And so that's why this plan, it counts so much on the young invincibles, because those people who really are at the least amount of risk of needing to have catastrophic coverage, they're the ones who are really paying for this extended coverage to the rest of the population.
So is there a specific way that these, you know, young people will be affected other than maybe they did have health insurance already? Like, if you already have health insurance, how is your life going to change now that you have to pay for it, I guess?
83% of the population is actually covered right now. And so of that 25 million, it's expected that 13 million will be covered by the individual mandate. The other 12 million will be covered by an expansion in Medicaid. But if you're in that 83%, that involves people that are already on Medicaid, Medicare, or have employer insurance. If you have insurance under your current company that you're working for, you might not see direct effects. You're probably going to keep your own plan. But here's the problem. If your company is giving you pretty skimpy coverage that doesn't meet the criteria that Obamacare set forth, they will have to cancel it, and your company will have to pay for a higher premium, higher quality coverage. And your company is compelled to warn you about this, but that money comes from somewhere, and it very likely could come for your wages. Maybe not at first, but it could mean that you get a raise a year later than you would otherwise.
Are there any other effects that this would have through who you work for or different companies offering health insurance now?
One thing that Obamacare made sure is that any company with at least 50 full-time employees needs to provide sufficient coverage. And they wanted to disincentivize companies from getting rid of their coverage and throwing people into the individual market. Because you could see, if you're a company, it costs money to buy this insurance. And if you know then get subsidies in the individual exchange, you might as well just end it. What the law says is that if you have at least 50 full-time employees, you have to provide this coverage. That raises the question, could companies then cut hours to make it so they're part-time? Or could the companies stop growth at 49 workers? A lot of things in the news are speculative about this. It's true that the marginal cost of the 50th worker, where then you need to buy health insurance, that's a very real thing to worry about. But the whole switch to part-time hours, this is something that a lot of conservatives like to bring up as all these people are going to lose their jobs and companies are going to be incentivized to cut hours. But we don't know yet because the law is not in effect, first of all. Second of all, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis did a survey, and it showed that only 4% of companies were planning on adjusting their hours or employment at all. And it's hard to draw research, let's say in the next 10 years, about which companies didn't grow because of this hurdle of the 50th employer and which ones didn't. For all intents and purposes, for now, it doesn't seem to be that big of an issue compared to the overall overhaul of the entire system.
Yeah, that doesn't really seem too comparable when you look at it, the bigger picture of people who don't receive fair health care now.
Going back to your previous question of who's against this and who's for it, when you're expanding coverage and trying to keep costs neutral, obviously the burden is shifted to somebody. There are people that will be paying more because of this.
How does this affect healthcare providers like doctors, hospitals, other than, you know, I don't really know.
It's an honest question. So obviously this is a huge overhaul and we have so many new people entering the market. And when you have an increased demand for the medical care, that means prices are probably going to go up. But what Obamacare is trying to do then with the individual exchange, for example, is get rid of this market failure where people aren't competing for their insurance policies. You sort of just passively sign up for one because your company has or used to have them. So by shopping online, it's going to be a little more competition. Hopefully prices will go down. Some doctors are worried about it. For example, with Medicare and Medicaid, the government's so huge that it has a lot of bargaining power and can usually bargain lower prices for their customers. And doctors don't always want to pay those lower prices. It's hard to tell really what is going to happen over the next 10 years. If we want to evaluate the quality of a healthcare system, you could say there are three things we aim for. There's affordability, coverage, and quality. Obamacare maybe is sacrificing a little bit of quality for more coverage and more affordability.
I feel like that's what I hear from politicians and people who campaign against this, that the quality of healthcare for those who have it now will go down.
It's very possible because really this tackles the issue from the demand side. How are we going to get people access to healthcare? But it doesn't do anything for the supply side, making healthcare more efficient. The definition of economic growth is being more efficient, doing more with the same amount of resources. And this isn't doing anything to make doctors what they do cost less.
So what's the phase-in process for this new bill? How should consumers of healthcare expect this to phase in? What are they going to see change first, I guess?
Right now, there's an open enrollment period on the individual exchange, but the rollout of healthcare.gov was so catastrophic, it's possible that they might have to have an extension. They're even getting Google and Oracle to run the website for them. I mean, it's sort of this textbook example of government idiocy or something. The point is that people go on that website and buy their plan. If the plan that they had before wasn't sufficient enough, they would have gotten a cancellation notice from their provider. And then if you were working for a company that didn't have a sufficient enough plan, they also would have notified you of the change. Of the 25 million, we said some of them are going to go into the individual exchange market and get a subsidy, but that leaves a huge chunk of people that will be covered by an expansion of Medicaid. So the people that are qualified for the subsidy under the individual exchange is if you make between 100 and 400% of the poverty level, which means between $11,500 and $46,000 if you're an individual, or up to $96,000 for a family of four. If you're below that, you'll be covered by an expansion of Medicaid. If you're above that, you'll pay these premiums without getting a subsidy. And so those are definitely the losers in this whole thing. It's self-employed people, for example, that are in their 50s, doing well, and maybe have led incredibly healthy lives. But if you're making $100,000 a year, you could be paying up to $800 a month.
And that's a lot more than what they pay now.
Most likely. Or they could have had a really good plan before, and it's the same one. It's for the people who had plans who weren't meeting those sufficient criteria.
And there's no way to switch plans to receive a lower rate.
That's what the individual health exchange is trying to do. If you get the cancellation notice, you go and shop for a new one that needs to meet this certain criteria.
Okay, so the people who are making a good amount can still receive pretty reasonable rates?
They'll receive the same rates as other people, at least the sticker price, as they call it. It's the subsidies that they won't get. A lot of times the media, people are having these scare stories where their plans are canceled and suddenly they need to pay $400 a month. Then they go on healthcare.gov and figure out they're eligible for a $350 subsidy. So that's something to really keep in mind, is that a lot of people whose plans were canceled, first of all, they're probably pretty crappy. They're eligible for the subsidy that makes up for a huge part of it. It's kind of like when you talk about college tuition, the sticker price might be $40,000, but if the average financial aid for a student is $20,000, then really the effective price is $20,000. So it's important to look at that real price rather than the sticker one.
Okay. And then continuing with your scholarship analysis, yeah. people who have the extension of Medicaid, mm-hmm. they have it all paid for, I guess?
So Medicaid is the government assistance program for the poor. And when Obama first signed this into law, it was under the promise that the federal government would fund the expansion of Medicaid 100% for 3 years and then gradually step it down until it was 90% funded in 2020. Sounds like a pretty good deal for the states. However, at this point, about 20 states have either said they won't go with the expansion or they've yet to decide. So that's 20 states where people really could fall through the cracks. And this came down to a court case that went to the Supreme Court, and basically the Supreme Court decided that states did not have to participate in this expansion if they didn't want to. And it sounds pretty weird, right? Especially if it's fully funded.
Yeah.
Personally, I think that these states are being just totally political and foolish. There's a lot of fiscal conservatives that want to stand up the next election and say, I refused this Obamacare money. Kind of like they did with the stimulus. That's my overall consensus. However, there is a little bit of a justification. States do have the experience of getting money from the federal government and rarely with no strings attached. You know, that's what this is being presented as. For example, in education, the No Child Left Behind Act, by certain measurements, the federal government is responsible for 90% of regulations in education, but it only provides a third of the money. You could see a state just being like, I'm not getting that much money for this. Why do I have to comply with all your standards? So if you're a state that's skeptical and you think, you know, maybe in a few years, Obamacare is defunded or we're running bankrupt in our Medicaid system, suddenly the federal government takes the money away. Well, any politician will tell you that once people have entitlements coming to them, it's really hard to take them away. And so these states would then be compelled to fund it. And that's what they're, at least on the surface, saying the reasoning is for not accepting the money.
That makes sense, but those who would be receiving the Medicaid, I can assume that they have no health insurance right now.
Yes, this expansion would only affect people who have no coverage. And by definition, Medicaid is for the people who are at the poverty line or lower.
So wouldn't those state taxpayers be paying for their injuries or whatever they needed?
Right. So in the case where they're rushing into the ER
right.
and need coverage, yes, taxpayers are going to pay for it. So, I mean, it's generally foolish. And in the state of Texas, we have one of the highest rates of children who are uninsured and child poverty rates. And so the fact that we're refusing this expansion is really odd when you think about it.
Yes, it is. I feel like the states would be paying, in the long run, possibly less.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, you know, if the federal government does tone it down, or maybe the next Congress defunds that part of the bill, in which case they'd be fully justified. But for now, I personally just think it's a foolish political thing where they can say, I was so against Obamacare that I refuse this money.
Seems like a lot of this is political.
Yes, which is really interesting because this is a huge overhaul to the system, like we said before. But relative to reforms that would really change the system, it's not that big. Obama is still keeping a lot of market forces in there with the individual exchange, and the government isn't actually providing services. They're only paying for it, which is a pretty big difference. In the UK, for example, you have single payer and single provider. The government is running hospitals and paying for all of it. Obama is still keeping a lot of the current infrastructure intact. And so when Republicans sort of decry it as social medicine, or people on the left really think this will be a utopia, I don't know. The more I learn about it, the more I see that it's timid compared to a lot of other alternatives.
So I guess that's where the line is between government-funded healthcare and socialized healthcare
right.
is.
In judging Obamacare, it might have its pluses and minuses, but the political reality is that we sort of had this worst of both worlds. Most people don't know this, but the government spends 46% of all healthcare dollars. That means 54% is being provided by people out of pocket or their healthcare plans or something. But if the government is spending 46 cents to the dollar, that means a lot of it is coming from the public sectors. I think when I hear the term private healthcare, it's really misleading.
Is this going to directly affect? I've never paid for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to, I guess, expect to start paying for healthcare when I don't get it from my parents anymore?
You get a job right after college, you could be covered by your employer then. Another important stipulation of Obamacare, at least for the proverbial 24-year-old that this is focused on, or people in their mid-20s, is that you're mandated to be covered under your parents until you're 26. It used to be that you were covered until you were 21 or if you were a full-time student. My older siblings graduated college and didn't have that luxury. And, you know, the rates that they had to pay were really bad. They're healthy people, but they were still faced with these incredible costs. If you graduate and you don't have a job, then you can go until you're 26, as long as your parents still have a plan.
Okay.
But if they don't, and if your job doesn't, you will be forced to go to the individual exchange. But, remember that if, you know, let's say you're unemployed or making not much money, you'll probably be eligible for a subsidy that will make up for it.
It's almost as intimidating now to think if there wasn't an Obamacare, what healthcare program am I going to choose, even if this didn't exist, even if I wasn't forced to buy it?
Absolutely. I definitely benefited when I graduated from that extension to 26 when I didn't have a job with benefits right out of college. But remember that that money does come from somewhere. It's not like, boom, you got to pay till you're 26. We're all better off. So that meant that everyone else was paying higher rates. And this is the trade-off we have to understand, that when we're expanding coverage, people are paying more. And in the case of Obamacare, the people that are paying more are generally the invincibles, the people who didn't need health care before or didn't think they needed it before.
So we are paying for sick people.
that is one way to put it, is you're shifting the burden to help those who need it. And along those lines, the whole pre-existing condition thing, you can hear a lot of horror stories, which actually might not be that atypical, where people break their ankle, have some sort of weird disease for a couple months, and then it can take up to 5 years until it's no longer considered a pre-existing condition. Before, for that long, you could be denied coverage or have astronomical rates. If you think of a hypothetical 50-year-old man, woman, whatever, and they get laid off, bad economy, they go more than 3 months without a job that has benefits. Now, if they try to get back into the healthcare market, they could be denied healthcare until they're eligible for Medicare because of that pre-existing condition. That was the previous reality. Yes, the young people are paying for the sick, for the old in general, but still, those people with pre-existing conditions, I mean, those were really some real stories.
I guess it's a game of choosing between unfair health insurers and assumedly unfair government mandates.
There's no utopia here. And like I said before, the status quo is so complicated. We have these layers upon layers. We've got Medicare, Medicaid, company-provided insurance, individual insurance. And I mean, I have to hand it to Obamacare for making a decent attempt at a really bad situation. The reality we have now is the result of a lot of bad historic policies. One thing that all economists basically agree on is that there's this tax cut that employees get for buying healthcare, which has made it so people's really options of getting affordable healthcare are tied to their employer. And that produces a thing called job lock, where people might not go on to a new job because they want to keep their plan.
So as of now, there is no system in place to monitor these healthcare providers?
You mean to make sure they're sort of providing
right.
Fair? Well, you could say there is some competition. Some states, for example, might have 5 healthcare providers. So that's who you're competing. There's not too much competition, but they theoretically should be competing with each other. The problem with the way that American health insurance is set up is that if I'm getting it through my employer is buying it from a healthcare provider who is then paying the doctor. You see, there's like a few degrees of separation there where no one is really seeking out the best plan. And the government, because it spends so much on Medicare and Medicaid, and now with this individual exchange, they are bargaining for lower prices. But, you know, if you go into a grocery store and you see all the prices next to each other, that competition is very real at making costs go down. And you could say that some bad incentives or misinformation, there's not the presence of that in the healthcare industry.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm understanding this correctly, you don't really get to choose your healthcare provider now if it's provided by your employer.
Correct.
But now you'll be able to choose, at least to some degree, what you'll be paying for.
Yes, to some degree what you're paying for. So if you want the bronze plan or if you
right.
want the platinum plan. But remember the distinction between the health insurer and mm-hmm. the doctor. That's a really good point, actually. Your employer chooses, let's say, Blue Cross Blue Shield. And if the doctor you've been going to for decades is no longer in network, you've got to find a new doctor. And so now on the individual exchange, you can at least choose your provider. What's interesting is that so much focus has been put on the individual exchange, whereas we said before, 83% of the population is already covered. So they're not even going to be directly affected by this.
Why are people so mad?
I mean, mandating people to buy insurance, especially the healthy and responsible, subsidizing the unhealthy and old, there's definitely a moral argument of just take care of yourself. And then obviously that's a broad generalization because you have the pre-existing conditions. You have people who just want affordable care and can't find it because of the adverse selection problem. A lot of genuine issues there that I think make it contentious. So one thing we can look to sort of see what possible results could happen from Obamacare is his old presidential rival, Mitt Romney, and the only two elected officials that have issued an individual mandate in healthcare are Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And it's not a total apples to apples comparison because Massachusetts is, interesting fact, the wealthiest political entity in the world with at least 6 million people. So the fact that they have so much money separates them from the rest of the country. RomneyCare actually did pretty well in expanding coverage. One case that it did not improve as well as people thought was medical bankruptcies. Medical bankruptcies are the cause of most bankruptcies in America. And if you make people buy insurance, you might prevent that. So it's sort of a long-term cost savings. But the evidence shows that RomneyCare didn't do it. At this point, especially with the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare in effect, most of RomneyCare has been repealed. But they also didn't have catastrophic effects. They might have not had all of the good solutions we want, but it also shows that if you get the system up and running, there can be some good results.
One thing I just thought of is these 24-year-olds, young 20s, people who don't have health insurance. Yes, it might be because we don't need it, in our minds, don't need it.
Right.
But what about those who can't afford it? Because they are 20 and they haven't been working long enough to have generated a substantial income.
Exactly. That's why I think pretty much every provision of this bill touches upon the people in their mid-20s. So if you have parents that have coverage, you're covered by them. If you are young and otherwise didn't want it, now you have to get it. But also, if you're right out of college or if you didn't go to college, you probably won't be able to afford care. And so if your income suits it, you can now afford it. I mean, it's definitely, it's helping people that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it.
Do you predict that those with health insurance now are going to be paying more?
Overall, their rates could go up. The Congressional Budget Office, which does projections for this, has said that the deficit will fall in the next 10 years. And that's very possible because we sort of describe the economic reasons for why it might cut costs overall. But approach those studies with skepticism because whenever the CBO or any macro study is done, they use models and parameters that usually already agree with what Obamacare wants to do. Overall, I'm not sure where this is going to lead 10 years from now. And that's important to know is how do we judge whether this is a success? Especially with healthcare outcomes, you have to wait a long time. It's like education. It's not, oh, this many fewer people have cancer. And so 10 years from now, how do you judge how healthy people are? How do you judge what's affordable? If we're expanding coverage, but the coverage is really bad, is it still a success?
Right, especially if some people see their wages going down, like you said.
And it's hard to tease that out. So if we see healthcare going up and wages going down, people might not really know that's what it's responsible for. So just to come full circle, this whole idea of the proverbial 24-year-old being an essential part of this law and counting on the 24-year-olds for it to be effective, the individual mandate was the anchor of the whole thing. Because if you don't get people to sign up, rates are going to go up. And that's why from that Supreme Court case, you know, they didn't say states had to expand their Medicaid, but they did say they had to keep the individual mandate. So that's an incredibly important part of it. However, people still might not sign up. I was talking to someone trying to get their personal experience from it. They didn't even know their old plan was canceled. Not going to say that this podcast might have saved her life, but I will say that now it got her thinking about, okay, I've got to look for a new plan. How many people are in that position where they don't know they need to sign up or they're going to take the $95 fine?
I mean, I'm just thinking of everyone I know that has never had to pay for health insurance, and the first time they do, it'll be mandatory.
Exactly. When we look at Obama's biggest supporters, it was people our age. And I'm not sure everyone really is aware that they're being forced to buy this. Talking to another person, I feel like a politician, you know, all these personal stories, but Talking to someone over the weekend, she was paying $70 a month. Been to the doctor once in the last 10 years, very healthy. Now her rate's going up to $350 a month. That's not going to make a lot of people our age happy. And yes, people are eligible for subsidies. They're going to get some support. There'll be a lot of people that are facing high plans, and it'll be interesting to see if a high percentage of them opt for the fine rather than going through with the individual exchange.
Especially if the fine, what did you say, 1% of their income?
And then it goes up over the next few years. It's whichever is higher. If you're at the poverty level, which is $9,500, that's a $95 fine. That's why that's the benchmark. But if you're making, let's say, $40,000, $400 is a pretty big fine, and you're not getting health insurance in that case. So it's really, they want to design a system where it's to your best interest to sign up. So what do you think? Overall, do you think it's a better trade-off from the old one, or you think it'll cause more problem than it solves?
I'm fortunate to have never been sick. I'm used to being very privileged and getting to go to the doctor when I need to go. But
Because you were under my mom.
But I can see myself taking the fine straight out of college when I turn 27 and I don't get to suck the benefits from my parents anymore.
Right.
Which is sad because I can't imagine living without health insurance. But
hopefully you'll have a job.
If I can pay for it, I will.
Maybe by then upset patterns will be new. This American life.
Knowing what I know now, I feel like it would be the right thing to do. It seems almost prejudiced to not offer health care to those just because of pre-existing conditions or
right.
how they live their life.
Oh, yeah. And the way that a lot of insurance providers will sometimes come up with how they determine it is really unfair. But to go back to it, there is a rationale sometimes where we might think, okay, that's okay. So people that smoke cigarettes or people that don't take care of themselves, or to go back to the car insurance analogy, if you have a lot of speeding tickets and you're reckless, I think you should pay higher rates than the safer driver. The pre-existing condition thing, yeah, I agree. It's the least bad option. You're probably going to be then subsidizing some irresponsible people, but you're still taking care of a really bad market failure there.
I may be opening a can of worms, but it also might go back to the fact that some don't have access to education about healthy habits. And if we can't figure out a program to regulate that, then this might be the only way to start.
The can of worms has been opened. We'll only briefly address it. But like I said before, this takes care of the demand side, but not the supply side. So how do we make people healthier? Having health coverage doesn't mean that you're necessarily healthier. And actually, some studies suggest that the only benefits in the long term of expanded healthcare coverage are the mental security aspect. People, when they have medical bills or they're not insured, there's a lot of stress behind that. I mean, that's very real, but there's still evidence that suggests really good healthcare might not, you know, make you live longer, make you healthier. It's more the day-to-day activities like eating healthy foods and exercising.
No, that makes sense. When I think health insurance, I don't really think of the way I live my life. I think of the bus that will run me over 2 weeks from now.
It's a good situation for the Invincibles. They might not be irresponsible, but who knows if you get hit by a bus and they don't have insurance or a car. This is another can of worms, but I'm still going to mention it. We think of health insurance and health coverage as the same thing. To go back to car insurance, we have car insurance for catastrophic, unforeseen things. We don't have car insurance to fill up our gas tank, change our tires, or change our oil. Yet, when we talk about health insurance, we expect insurance providers to pay for routine visits, pay for the checkup, all of those things that you could say are a lot like putting gas in your car. There are a lot of alternatives out there of healthcare plans, and a lot of them have their pros and cons, and we don't have to get into all of them. But one that, from what I understand, is a really preferred alternative by a lot of economists is a Singapore model, where people will put tax-free income into a health savings account. And so that's what you pay for your medical bills. And then the government will pay for catastrophic things. You know, you get into an accident, you break your leg, cancer treatment, and they spend a lot less percentage of GDP and have pretty good health outcomes.
But the program now, I guess you could say, is paying for preventative medicine almost. Doctors, checkups.
Yes. And that's, you know, the whole Invincible thing is let's cover them before they have to get hit by a bus. Upset Patterns is hosted by Will Comprell and produced by Paige Jensen-Slattengren at Tequila Mockingbird Studios in Austin, Texas. My guest today has been Paige Atkinson. Want more sources related to today's podcast? Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/upsetpatterns.